Studio 360.
Given how ubiquitous memoirs are today, people actually get master's degrees in memoir writing. It's a little hard to fathom that just 50 years ago, an autobiography by a living African-American woman was rare, verging on non-existent. But that changed in 1969. That's when Maya Angelou, age 40, kind of a late bloomer as an author, published her first book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. It was the first of 7 autobiographies she published, and it became the first nonfiction book ever by a Black woman to become a bestseller. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings is a coming-of-age story about the racism and sexual abuse and other outrages Angelou encountered growing up. It's acclaimed, beloved, and also regularly subject to bans by school libraries. For the latest installment of our American Icons series, producer Sonia Green looks at how Angelou's first book came to be and became so important to so many people. A listener note, the story contains a racial slur that is part of the book.
Thanks to the book that launched her writing career, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, Maya Angelou is remembered as a writer of the highest order, but she lived nearly half her life before she wrote that book and had done just about everything to pay the bills. Here's the abbreviated version. At age 16, she was pregnant with her only son, Clyde Guy Johnson. To support him, she took on many jobs. She lied about her age to get a job as San Francisco's first Black female streetcar conductor. Later, she worked as a prostitute and ran a brothel. Then in the 1950s, she's singing at a club in San Francisco when she meets some cast members in the award-winning opera by Gershwin, Porgy and Bess. They ask if she can dance. She says yes. She's offered a role and goes on a 22-nation tour around the world with the company. Back in the States in 1957, she records her album, Miss Calypso.
These Yankee girls are giving me a big scare. Black the roots, blonde the hair. The eyelash falls, face is paint. Pads is where those girls, they ain't. We Calypso girls, good a lot. What you see is what we got.
She also ends up writing for television, is a journalist, a playwright, and a poet. She becomes friends with writers like Rosa Guy and James Baldwin.
Mr. Chairman.
She attends a speech of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s in Harlem.
The world organized politically and spiritually around the concept of the inequality of man.
She ends up befriending Dr. King.
Dignity of human personality.
And then, on her 40th birthday.
Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck.
She's devastated.
It just knocked me out.
That's Angelou from the 2016 documentary And Still I Rise. Her grief makes her relapse into a condition from her childhood, voluntary mutism.
And I fell into mutism again. I just couldn't bring myself.
Then her friend Baldwin steps in.
And finally, after about 5 days, James Baldwin came to my house. Bam-a-lam-a-lam on the door. Open this door. I'll call the police. So I opened the door, and he came and he saw I was really unkempt. And my house was a mess, and I've always loved a pretty house. And he said, go take a shower. Put some clothes on. I'm taking you somewhere.
He took her to a dinner party at the home of cartoonist Jules Feiffer and his then-wife, Judy.
And Baldwin asked me, tell a little bit about your grandma. Tell a little bit about Stamps, Arkansas. So I started by saying, in Arkansas, racism was so prevalent that Black people couldn't even eat vanilla ice cream. And so it made everybody laugh. And they asked me to tell a story, tell another.
The next day, Judy Feiffer calls her friend and editor at Random House, Robert Loomis, and she tells Loomis that Angelou is a gripping storyteller. Many years later, in a 1986 interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air, Angelou recalls that conversation she had with Loomis.
he phoned me a number of times, and I said, no, Robert Loomis. I said, no, I'm not. I'm not interested. Until he said to me, well, Miss Angelou, I guess it's just as well that you don't attempt this book, because to write autobiography as literature is almost impossible. So I thought, well, in that case, I'd better try.
And try she did. In Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where she lived, she would rent a room at the Brookstown Inn Hotel. Her only niece and archivist, Rosa Johnson, took me there.
We are at the historic Brookstown Inn. It's a hotel here in Winston-Salem where Dr. Angelou would come to do her writings. And here we are.
Johnson says her aunt would rent a room for the entire time she was writing.
She was an early riser, so she'd probably be down here like at 6 o'clock in the morning, maybe till the afternoon, and come home and have lunch.
She had a ritual.
And when she'd check in here, she would have the staff take any paintings or drawings off the walls, because she would have her thesaurus, her Bible, a bottle of sherry, and a yellow pad.
So with her Bible, her thesaurus, her bottle of sherry, and yellow pad, Angelou found her mind settling on her earliest memories.
When I was 3 and Bailey 4, we had arrived in the musty little town, wearing tags on our wrists, which instructed, to whom it may concern, that we were Marguerite and Bailey Johnson, Jr., from Long Beach, California, en route to Stamps, Arkansas, in care of Mrs. Annie Henderson.
This is where life begins for Maya Angelou, born Marguerite Johnson. For the first several years of her life, she, along with her brother Bailey, are raised by her grandmother. That's Mrs. Annie Henderson and Uncle Willie. Mrs. Henderson owns the only store in the black section of town. Joanne Gabin runs the Furious Flower Poetry Center at James Madison University. She also teaches Angelou's work in her English class.
And so when she takes us to Stamps, Arkansas, we can see the fear that Uncle Willie has to go through, has to hide in a vegetable bin to avoid the Ku Klux Klan.
From the side of the store, Bailey and I heard him say to Mama, Annie, tell Willie he better lay low tonight. A crazy nigger messed with a white lady today. Some of the boys will be coming over here later. Even after the slow drag of years, I remember the sense of fear which filled my mouth with hot, dry air and made my body light.
She knew early on that because of racism, black people were hated.
She briefly leaves her life in Stamps when her father shows up and takes her and Bailey to live with their mother in St. Louis. Marguerite was almost 8 years old, and it is here that she's raped by her mother's boyfriend. The man is arrested, put on trial, and found guilty. And the day after the trial, he was killed, possibly by her uncles. This is the first time Angelou goes mute.
Just my breath, carrying my words out, might poison people, and they'd curl up and die like the black fat slugs that only pretended. I had to stop talking.
After 5 years of not speaking, reading is what eventually helped the writer speak again. Among the authors she read was Paul Laurence Dunbar. His poem Sympathy would inspire the title for I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings that she would write decades later.
I would like to read the Dunbar poem, if I may.
Professor Emeritus from the College of William and Mary, Joanne Braxton.
I know what the caged bird feels, alas, when the sun is bright on the upland slopes.
Braxton wrote about Angelou's autobiography and black women writing autobiography, a tradition within a tradition.
She identified with that caged bird, with this tremendous impulse to fly, to be free of that cage. And while there were many ways in which she could not escape the immediate oppressions of her environment, she could test them through imaginary flights of literature.
I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings was released in 1969. Prior to 1970, sexism played a role in who was allowed to tell the story of being black in America. Seldwyn Kajow, professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College.
If you look at all the major biographies, be it Frederick Douglass, be it Washington, women voices are silent. So you don't hear the women. They were just their wives or their helpmates, but they're never painted or printed or published or articulated.
Furious Flower Executive Director Joanne Gabin.
There were very few autobiographical pieces that I knew of by Black women. And so Maya Angelou's was among the first.
The power of Angelou's story is that she is a Black woman.
But the early Black woman tradition really comes into being in the 1970s. Now, significantly enough, in 1970, a number of works come out that sort of give us a sense of women voices. For example, you have Toni Morrison's The Blues Eye, 1970. You have Maya Angelou, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. We have Louis Merriweather's, In Terms of Daddy Was a Numbers Runner, 1970. You have Alice Walker, The Third Life of Grange Coupland. And of course, it ended, of course, in that very same year with Michelle Wallace's very powerful work, Black Macho and the Myth of the Superwoman.
Angelou's book demonstrates all the forces that Black women still grapple with in what some call intersectionality today. Kimberly Crenshaw formed the theory to describe how our overlapping social identities relate to structures of racism and oppression.
She's already talking about intersectionality. We just didn't have the terminology that Kimberly Crenshaw most brilliantly brought forth after the fact. But she had illustrated intersectionality without calling it that. She called it a tripartite crossfire.
The Black female is assaulted in her tender years by all those common forces of nature at the same time that she is caught in the tripartite crossfire of masculine prejudice, white illogical hate, and Black lack of power.
Which, if you think about it, is a little bit more charged than intersectionality, which sounds more neutral by comparison.
You cannot talk about Angelou without talking about her influence or relationship to other Black women writers.
You could not have A Color Purple without A Caged Bird Sings. It opens up a space.
The Color Purple by Alice Walker came in 1982, 13 years after I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Angelou's book shows her struggles with race and class. As a teenager, she works as a maid alongside Miss Glory. Their employer, Mrs. Cullinan, one day decides to call Angelou, who was Margaret to her, Mary, because a friend said her name was too long. Marguerite was furious. Reverend Serena Churn, the senior pastor at Mount Zion Baptist Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Angelou was a member for decades.
If you visited Dr. Angelou in her home, surely she had, you know, the home staff. But she treated them with the utmost respect and expected you to. When she would introduce them, this is Mr. So-and-so. This is Mrs. So-and-so. It wasn't, you know, J.D., whatever. No, no.
She would insist that whoever came across her door and respect everybody in that house. Yes, it's my housekeeper, but that's Miss Thomas. That's not married to you. And I've seen times when she had people to leave because they didn't give the due respect to the women in the household.
Angelou did not take matters of respect lightly. Not long ago, a tweet resurfaced a 90s video of a teenage girl addressing the author.
I wanted to ask Maya her views on interracial relationships.
Oh, thank you. And first, I'm Miss Angelou.
Miss Angelou.
Yes, ma'am. I'm not Maya. I'm 62 years old. I have lived so long and tried so hard that a young woman like you or any other have no license to come up to me and call me by my first name.
For some, the debate was not about what she said, rather.
I am never here for any Black person scolding another Black person around white folks. I am never here for that.
That's from King of Reeds on YouTube.
I'm tired of respectability politics. I am tired of this notion that just because someone has status, class, I have to address them as because.
For others, it was more a matter of respect, something Braxton says Angelou tried to achieve through her writing.
So in the tradition of the slave foremothers and the women missionaries and ministers who wrote autobiographies before her. She is negotiating for respect, not merely for herself. For herself, yes, but also for others like her, that they might be recognized both as fully human and also as representing a spark of the divine.
You also cannot talk about Angelou in only literary terms.
If you just see the great actress that she was, the great dancer that she was, the great musician that she was, you miss her if you don't realize that this is a woman of tremendous faith and tremendous dependence on God.
I visited Reverend Churn in his office one Sunday after his church service.
She came to see me one day. Well, it was summer. We had our summer camp. And I knew her car had arrived. And she never showed. I finally went downstairs, found her surrounded by kids, rapping. You know, Dr. Angelou could, you know, people tried today. Dr. Angelou could rap. She had those kids enthralled.
The album she recorded way back before her writing career in 1957 is one of the many reasons Angelou is sometimes dubbed the godmother of hip hop.
She was speaking the times, the struggle, to a beat on Miss Calypso in 1957, just drums and her voice on beat. I don't know anyone who came before her, at least within the recorded era of music.
That is music producer Sean Rivera.
I'm sure that our ancestors kept history by putting words in stories to music because we couldn't write it down. But as far as what we know as hip-hop today, Maya Angelou was the pioneer.
Rivera discovered Angelou's book in 2007. It was life-changing and inspired Caged Bird Songs, an album he worked with Angelou on for 7 years. It was released in November 2014, 6 months after her death. The songs are from her poems, some of which are based on experiences from the book.
She talks about, there's a long-legged girl in San Francisco by the Golden Gate. She said she'd give me all I wanted, but I just couldn't wait, right? And it made me laugh because for someone who seemed to be so presidential and prim and proper, I didn't realize how she came from the same kind of streets I was raised in, and then some before they were what they are. She became this, I could connect with her through the book in a way that the poetry only alluded to.
There's a long-legged girl in San Francisco by the Golden Gate. She said she'd give me all I wanted, but I just couldn't wait. I started to picking them up and laying them down. Picking them up and laying them down. Picking them up and laying them down. Getting to the next town, baby. To picking them up, laying them down. Picking them up, laying them down. Picking them up and laying them down.
The album has a cult-like following.
People are still discovering it, and that's one of those things when you're as timeless as Dr. Angelou, there's no rush. When I found her book almost 40 years after it was written, and it still changed the trajectory of my life to this day. So 40 years from now, you know, my great-grandkids will be just as inspired by it.
You've heard of Banned Book Week. It started with one book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
There was a challenge to her book in 1982 that came to the attention of a small group of publishers, booksellers, and librarians that were working on a display for what's turned into BookCon today.
Deborah Caldwell Stone is the interim director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association.
It was the idea that her book was being banned, a nominee for multiple awards, an actual award-winning book, great work of literature is being removed from the schools based on the objections to the, you know, use of language and sexual situations that were challenging but relevant and important to the book that really spurred these individuals to bring a focus to book censorship.
In 1990, years after the office was inspired to work on banned books, they started keeping a yearly list of the top books banned. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings has made the list hundreds of times.
What's cited most often in the listed challenges is profanity, explicit sexual activity, or the description of explicit sexual activity, and sometimes very vague references to the book not representing, quote, traditional values, unquote.
Caldwell Stone says there will always be challenges to I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings because it itself is a challenge to the status quo.
It forces individuals to confront their preconceptions of culture, of race, of class, and people find that profoundly disorienting and uncomfortable. And I think as long as literature does that, and in fact, isn't that the task of literature, to challenge us, to cause us to question ourselves and our beliefs?
Joanne Gabin.
Maya Angelou was right on target when she said this has to be not only recognized, but young people have to read about this. Not only did she give us that scene in terms of the rape, but she also talked about the very hard issues of racism, of racial violence. And so she tells us these stories that are sometimes hard to hear, but must be heard.
Earlier in her life, Angelou struggled to find her voice, sometimes literally, when she did not speak. In finding it and writing about it, she helped others find theirs.
This book was the closest thing for me to feeling understood by someone who had walked a path and emerged successfully from a childhood of abuse.
I identified with her as a young Black girl, the young Black girl who is still alive and inside me, who experienced terrible things that I don't want to talk about. She became a champion for me.
For me too. During my interview with Braxton, she asked me why I wanted to produce this story in particular.
I did not encounter it until college, and it changed my life in ways that I didn't even know how to articulate. So yeah, I get emotional.
Good.
Talking to Braxton took me back to reading the book as a college student in the 90s. I saw myself for the first time in the words. My story of rape at a young age, racism, and identity was not unique, but it was also not normal. And I felt validation. Angelou's niece.
There's family dynamics that we as a people don't often talk about, like mental health issues or incest and rape that goes on in the family. And so by Auntie writing about those things, it opened the door for us to realize and acknowledge our pain.
This is perhaps the greatest lasting impact of the book. Joanne Braxton.
I think it's critically important to recognize that her text offers itself as a counter narrative to the American historical narrative that remains his story by bringing her Black and female voice forward to say, in the words of Langston Hughes, I too sing America.
The fact that the adult American Negro female emerges a formidable character is often met with amazement, distaste, and even belligerence. It is seldom accepted as an inevitable outcome of the struggle won by survivors and deserves respect, if not enthusiastic acceptance.
I'm the best that ever done it. Pow, pow. That's my title and I want it. Pow, pow. I ain't lying, I'm the best. Pow, pow.
Maya Angelou died in 2014. She was 86. Sonia Green produced our story. She is based in Macon, Georgia, where she's a reporter at Mercer University's Center for Collaborative Journalism. Pedro Rafael Rosado was the engineer. All of Studio 360's American icons are made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. And you can find dozens more of our American icons, stories like that, and hour-long documentaries at studio360.org. Any way you want to read it, maybe it's your mom and me.